My talent for envisioning things and spinning yarns in my head failed me that evening, as if it had gone on vacation. I could make no sense of my interview with Spellicon. I put it down as further evidence that Sir Trestinus was cracking and would soon be sent to Physician's Commons to get better, hopefully very slowly. The next day I was up early to help serve breakfast. I spent the morning in a chalk hall with Barb, working on some fundamentals of exterior calculus that I should have understood years earlier, but was only now getting a real grip on. As I was reaching the point where my brain couldn't take any more and noticed myself making dumb mistakes, Provener rang. This was one of the days that my old team was supposed to wind the clock, so I went to the Minster. It was sparsely attended, with few hierarchs in evidence. I didn't see Fra Orlo or any of his senior students, and Jessery didn't show up, so Leo and Arcibald and I had to do it without his help. Between that and the long morning in the chalk hall, I was famished and ate like a dog in the refectory. When I was almost finished, Orlo came in, fetched himself a light lunch, and sat down alone in what had become his favorite spot, the table from which he could look out the window and down the mountains when the weather was clear. Today it wasn't, but it felt as though the clouds might later be rinsed away by a cold, clear river of wind. When I had finished eating, I went over and sat with him. I guessed that Spellicon must have been pestering him with questions too, but I didn't want to bring it up. He must be sick of it. He gave me a little smile. "Thanks to the hierarchs," he said, "I shall soon be making observations again." "They're going to open the Starhenge? Well, that's great news!" I exclaimed. Orlo smiled again. Things were beginning to make sense. Something had spooked the hierarchs. They had misinterpreted Orlo's pre-apert activities in a way I still didn't understand. Now, finally, they were coming to see that they'd been mistaken, and things were about to go back to normal. "I must admit I have a tablet up in the M&M that I've been dying to get my hands on," he said.
"When are they going to open it?"
"I don't know," Orlo said.
"What are you going to look at first?"
"Oh, I'd rather not say just now. Nothing that requires the power of the M&M. A smaller telescope would suffice, or even a commercial spelecaptor."
"Spellicon was asking me all kinds of questions about those."
He put a finger to his lips. "I know," he said. "And it is good that you answered his questions as you did." I was distracted for a few moments, working through the implications. The news was good. But when people began going up to the Starhenge again, they might find the tablet I had left in Clesthera's eye, which could get me in a lot of trouble. I felt stupid now for having put it there. How was I going to fetch it back? Orlo looked out a different window, reading the time from the clock. "I saw Tullia a few minutes ago. She and Ayla were rounding up the team. She asked me to give you a message."
"Yes?"
"She won't be turning up for this meal. She'll see you at supper."
"That's the message?"
"Yes. The team have got some unusual changes to bring. It's going to require their full attention. They'll be starting in half an hour or so. She seemed to think that you, of all people, would find this especially important. I've no idea why."
Voco. It had to be another Voco. So I was going to get my chance to sneak up to the Starhenge again. That was the real message that Tullia was trying to send me.
Did Orlo understand all of this? Did he know what was going on? But once the changes began to ring, I couldn't very well go charging up the Minster stairs against the traffic of Regulant and Fendant staff coming down to attend the Aught. This was only going to work if I ascended first, before the bell sounded, and hid myself up there. And I had a perfect excuse for doing so, thanks to Leo.
I stood up.
"See you in the Minster," I said to Orlo.
"Yes," he said,
and then winked.
"Or perhaps not."
I was frozen for a moment, again wondering how much he knew. This made him smile broadly.
"All I meant," Orlo said, "was that one never knows who will remain in the Minster after one of these aughts and who will depart."
"You think you might be called up at Voco?"
"It is most unlikely," Orlo said. "But just in case you are called..."
I snorted. Now he was just having fun with me.
"Just in case you are called," he said,
know that I have seen the progress you have been making in recent months. I am proud of you. Proud, but not surprised. Do keep at it.
All right, I said. I'll keep at it. In fact, I have some questions for you later, but I have to run.
Run then, he said. Mind your step on those stairs.
I turned around and forced myself to saunter, not sprint, out of the refectory. I fetched my drawing frame and sketches from the niche where I'd been stashing them and walked as quickly as I could, without looking like I was in a hurry, to the minster. When I had ascended to the triforium, I looked over to the bell ringer's balcony and saw Ayla and Tullia and their team there, going through the motions of the changes they were about to ring without actually pulling on the ropes. Tullia saw me. I looked away, not wanting to be obvious, then went the other way and climbed the southwest tower stairs as briskly as I could. The Regulant Court was as crowded as I had ever seen it, but quiet, as everyone seemed intent on something, which made sense just before Evoco. I actually saw Sewer Trustiness for a moment as she was passing from one office to another. She looked a little surprised, but then her gaze dropped to take in my drawing equipment, and she saw me attacking the next flight of stairs. Something clicked into place in her mind, and she forgot about it. Leo was waiting for me by the statue of Amnectris, looking a little flushed himself from climbing the stairs. He fell in step beside me.
"Don't go to the ledge," he said. "Too conspicuous. Come with me."
I hooded myself as I followed him around the inner walkway. Neither of us spoke, as we always seemed to be in earshot of someone. Finally, he dodged into a chamber that was lined with heavy wooden doors all around. A muster room, they called it, where a squad might gather to brief and equip before a mission.
"You planned this whole thing, didn't you?" I whispered.
"I created opportunities in case we might need them."
Leo slid one of the doors open to reveal a storage chamber lined with metal boxes, neatly stacked. Then he grabbed my bolt in front of my chest, yanked me forward, and shoved me into the locker. By the time I'd got my balance back, he had slid the door shut behind me. It was dark. I was hidden. No more than a minute later, the bells began to ring strange changes. My eyes had adjusted to the darkness. I took the minor risk of making my sphere give off a faint glow. The boxes stacked around me were stenciled with incomprehensible words and numbers, but I was growingly certain that they contained ammunition. I had heard stories. The lifetime of this stuff was a few decades. Then it had to be flung off the minster and shoveled into wagons to be carted off for disposal. The whole consent would then queue up on the stairs and convey the fresh ammunition up to this level by passing the boxes from hand to hand. This hadn't been done in a while, but some of the older avowed remembered it clearly. Anyway, it gave me something to think of while I waited through the ringing of the changes and the half hour of assembly time that followed. No one up here needed half an hour. They could go on about their business for 15 or 20 minutes and then hustle down at the last minute. So it took a while for the place to empty out. At some point, Fra Degelos himself made a sweep, commanding everyone to leave now. He wanted to be the last one down, and he didn't want to have to run. After that, I felt it was safe to go out into the muster room. I cracked the door of the locker and paused to let my eyes adjust, then crept out and squatted behind the exit door for a minute, just listening. But there was nothing to hear, not even from the chancel and the knaves, which sounded as if they had been abandoned. I was afraid that Degelos might still be hunting for stragglers, and there was no particular reason to hurry, so I waited until the voice of Statho resonated up the well, intoning the convocation. Then I bolted from cover, charged around to the stairs, and raced into the space above. Statho went on at some length, pausing from time to time as though sifting through hastily assembled notes or gathering strength. I was about halfway to the Starhenge, high up behind the face of the clock, when I first heard the word, Anathem. My knees collapsed like those of a beast when something unexpectedly touches its back. I lost my stride and had to stop myself and crouch down lest I bang into something. It couldn't be real. The Aught of Anathem had not been celebrated in this place for 200 years.
and yet I had to admit that the changes Tullia had rung had sounded new to my ears, different from Voco. The crowd in the minster had been dead quiet before the aught. Now they were muttering, producing a gravelly sound the likes of which I'd never heard. Everything that had happened since Appert now made sense in a new way, as if a pile of shattered fragments had been thrown up in the air and reassembled itself into a mirror. Some part of me said that I must keep moving, that this was my only chance to fetch that tablet. Not that the images stored on it mattered anymore. But Orlo had gone out of his way to tell me a few minutes ago that he wanted the tablet from the M&M. I had to get both of them. If I blew it, I'd get in huge trouble, perhaps be thrown back. Worse, I'd fail Orlo. How long had I been crouched on this catwalk, not moving? Wasted time, wasted time. I made myself move. Whose name would they call? Perhaps mine. What would happen then if I failed to step out? There was some dark humor in that. It got darker as I imagined one way to answer the call, by jumping down the center of the well. With luck, I'd land on Sewer Trustinus. Now that would be a story that would live on forever in the lore of Sant Edhar and the Mathic world beyond. Perhaps it would even make the local newspapers. But it would not get that tablet from Clesthra's eye, nor the one that Orlo wanted from the M&M. That was a prize worth taking risks for. I climbed as Statho read some ancient prattle about the discipline and how it must be enforced. Maybe I didn't climb as quickly as I might have, for I could tell he was leading up to the moment when he would call out the name of the one who was to be thrown back, and I wanted to hear it. I reached the top and put my hand on the door that led to the Starhenge and actually killed time for a minute. Finally, he said, "Orlo." Not Fra Orlo, for in that instant he had ceased to be a Fra. How could I be surprised? From the moment I had heard Anathem, I had known that it would be Orlo. Still, I said, "No!" out loud. No one heard me because everyone else was saying it in the same instant. It came up the well like the beat of a drum. As it died away, a very weird sound replaced it, something I'd never heard the likes of before. People were screaming down there. Why did I cry out no when I had known it all along? Not out of disbelief. It was an objection, a refusal, a declaration of war. Orlo was ready. He emerged through the door on our screen immediately and closed it firmly behind him before his former brothers and sisters could begin to say goodbye, for that would have taken a year. Better to just be gone, like one who is killed by a falling tree. He walked out into the chancel and tossed his sphere to the floor, then began to untie his cord. This dropped around his ankles. He stepped out of it and then reached down, grabbed the lower fringes of his bolt, and shrugged it off over his shoulders. For a moment, then, he was standing there naked, holding a wad of bolt in his arms and gazing straight up the well, just as Fra Paphlagon had done at Voco. I opened the door to the Starhenge and let the light flood in. Orlo saw it and bowed his head like a deolater praying to his god. Then I passed through and closed the door behind me. The entire terrible scene in the minster was eclipsed and replaced by the lonely vista of the Starhenge. In the same moment, I began sobbing out loud. My face drew back from my skull as if I were vomiting, and tears ran from my eyes like blood from gashes. I was sad rather than surprised, because I had known that this was coming from the moment Frostbellicon had begun asking about Spelecaptors. I hadn't foreseen it, only because it was too dreadful to think about until I could not escape it anymore. Until it had happened. Until now. So I didn't have to waste any time being astonished, like those Fras and Surs down below me. I went straight to the most intense and saturating grief I had ever known. I found my way to the pinnacle more by groping than by sight, as I could perceive little more than light and dark. By the time I had reached the top, I had moved on to hysterical blubbering, but I wiped my face a couple of times with my bolt, took some deep breaths, and settled myself long enough to get the dust cover open and withdraw the tablet from Clesthora's eye. This I wrapped in my bolt, which called to mind the memory of Orlo stripping his off. He would stand there naked while the Avout sang a wrathful song to anathematize him. They were probably singing it now. You were supposed to sing it like you meant it. Maybe that would be easy for the Thousanders and the Hundreders who had never known him, but I suspected that little coherent sound was coming from behind the tenor's screen. I went into the control chamber of the M&M and looked for the tablet that Orlo had placed in its objective when he and I had been here just before the whole place had been locked down. But it was empty. Someone had been here before me and confiscated it. Just as they would now go through the niches that he had used and take all of his writings. Then I did something that might have been foolish, but that was necessary. I went to the same place where I'd watched Fra Paflagon and the Inquisitors take off in their aircraft. I crouched at the base of the same megalith and waited until Orlo walked out of the day gate. Once he had passed out of the chancel and out of sight of the Avout, they had given him a sort of gunny sack to cover his body and an emergency blanket made of crinkly orange foil, which he pulled around his shoulders as he got out into the plaza and the wind hit him. His skinny white ankles were lost in a pair of old black work boots, and he had to shuffle lest they fall off. He moved away from the consent without once gazing back over his shoulder. After a few moments, he disappeared behind the spray of one of the fountains. I chose that time to turn my back on him and head back down. As I passed back into the chronochasm and heard the aught of Anathem concluding, I thought it was a small mercy for me that I'd had this last sight of Orlo Extramuros. Those in the minster merely saw him be swallowed by the unknowable beyond, which was, and was meant to be, terrifying. But I had at least seen him making his way out there, which didn't make things any less horrible and sad, but to glimpse him still alive and moving under his own power in the Seculum was to have hope that someone would help him out there. That maybe, before dark, he'd be sitting in hand-me-down clothes in one of those bars he had frequented during Appert, having a beer and looking for a job. The remainder of the service was a reaffirmation of vows and a rededication to the discipline. I was happy to miss it. I wrapped up the tablet in a leaf of drawing paper and stashed it behind a can of ammunition. Leo could always retrieve it later. The one question was, would my absence have been marked by any of the tenors? But in a group of 300, it was easy for such a thing to go unnoticed. In case anyone asked, I concocted a story that Orlo had dropped a hint of what was going to happen, which, come to think of it, he had, though I'd been too dense to get it, and that I had skipped the aught because I was afraid I couldn't bear it. This would still get me in trouble. I didn't much care. Let them throw me back. I'd figure out where Orlo had gone, probably to Bly's Butte, and join him there. But as it came out, I never had to tell anyone that lie. No one had noticed I was missing, or if they had, they didn't care. The story of how Orlo had come to be thrown back had to be reconstructed over the next few weeks, like a skull and an archaeological dig being fitted together one shard at a time. We would get lost for days as rumor or convincingly wrong data sent us up some promising path that only later proved a logical cul-de-sac. It didn't help that all of us had suffered the psychic equivalent of third-degree burns. He had somehow known, days before Appert, that there would be trouble related to the Starhenge. He had put Jessery to work doing some computations. He had not allowed Jessery to see the photomnemonic tablets from which the Givens had been extracted. Indeed, he'd gone to a lot of effort to obscure the nature of the work from Jessery and his other students, perhaps to shield them from any consequences. When Artisan Quinn had spoken of the technical capabilities of Flux Spelecaptor, the idea had come into Orlo's head that he might use such a device to make cosmographical observations. On the ninth night of Appert, after the Starhenge had been locked, Orlo had gone to the apiary and stolen several crates of mead. He put on clothes that made him look like a visitor from Extramuros and went out the Decade Gate with a large wheeled beer cooler in which he hid the loot. He made a rendezvous with a shady character of some description whom he had presumably met while hanging around in bars Extramuros. Indeed, his entire motive for having frequented such places during Appert might have been to recruit such a person. In exchange for the mead, Orlo had taken delivery of a Spiele captor. The little vineyard where Orlo pursued his avocation was difficult to see from the minster. During the winter, he sometimes went there to mend trellises and prune vines. In the weeks following Appert, he devised a rudimentary observatory there, consisting of a vertical pole somewhat taller than a man, free to rotate, with a crosspiece lashed athwart it at eye level that could be swiveled up and down. Into this crosspiece, he'd whittled a niche to fit the Spiele captor. The pole and crosspiece enabled him to hold the Spiele captor steady for long periods as he tracked his target across the sky. The device's image stabilization, zoom, and low-light enhancement features enabled him to get a decent look at whatever he was so curious about. The idea of Orlo stealing from the consent, conspiring with a criminal during Appert, and making forbidden observations in the vineyard was shocking to everyone. But the story did make sense, and it was just the kind of logical plan that Orlo would have come up with. Sooner or later, we all came to terms with it. My role in the story led some Edharians to view me as a traitor, as the guy who had sold Orlo out to the Warden Regulant. This was the kind of thing that, before Anathem, would have kept me up all night, every night, feeling bad. On even-numbered nights, I'd have felt guilty about what I had divulged to Spellicon, and on odd-numbered nights, I'd have seethed with impotent rage at those in my chapter who so misunderstood me. But against the backdrop of all that had been going on, being worried about these things was a little bit like attempting to see distant stars against the daytime sky. Even though Orlo was not my father, and even though he was still alive, I felt about Frost Spellicon as I would have about a man who had murdered my father before my eyes. And my feelings towards Sir Trustinus were even darker, since I suspected that, in some sneaky way, she was behind it. What had Orlo seen? We might have been able to get some clues from the computations Jessery had been doing before Appert, but the Warden Regulant had confiscated these from their niche, and so all we had to go on were Jessery's recollections. He was fairly certain that Orlo had been trying to calculate the orbital parameters of an object or objects in the solar system. Normally, this would imply an asteroid moving in a heliocentric, sun-centered orbit that happened to be similar to the orbit of Arb. A big nugget type of scenario, in other words. But Jessery had a hunch, based on certain of the numbers he remembered seeing, that the object in question was orbiting not the sun, but Arb. This was extremely unusual. In all the millennia that humans had been observing the heavens, only one permanent moon of Arb had been found. It was possible for an asteroid in a sun-centered orbit to pass near a libration point and be captured into an Arb-centered orbit, but all such orbits were unstable and ended with the rock striking Arb or the moon or being ejected from the Arb moon system. It might have been that Orlo was looking at the triangular libration points of the Arb moon system, which were suspected to harbor concentrations of rocks and dust, visible as faint clouds chasing or being chased by the moon in its orbit about Arb. But it was not clear why such a project would create so much hostility in the Warden Regulant. And as Barb had pointed out, the orientation of the M&M suggested that Orlo had been using it to take pictures of an object in a polar orbit, which was unlikely in a natural object. Of our group, it was Jessery who first had the courage to give voice to what was implied by all of this.
It is not a natural object. It was made and put there by humans.
It was not exactly spring. Winter was over, but frost still threatened. Bulbs were thrusting green spears up through crystalline mud ice. Several of us had spent the afternoon chopping down the dead stalks and vines of our tangles. We left these up through most of the winter to prevent soil erosion and provide a habitat for small animals, but the time of year had come when we had to take it all down and burn it so that the ashes could fertilize the soil. Now, following supper, we had gone out into the dark and set fire to the slash we had heaped up during the day, creating a huge gaseous fire that would not last for very long. Jesri had found a bottle of the peculiar wine that Orlo used to make, and we were passing it around.
It could also have been made by some other Praxic civilization, said Barb.
Technically, of course, he was right. Socially, he was annoying us. By putting forth his suggestion, Jesri had stuck his neck out, had exposed himself to the risk of ridicule. By agreeing with them, silently or not, we were accepting the same risk. The last thing we needed was Barb speculating about bug-eyed space monsters. Another thing about Barb. He was the son of Quinn, who, in a sense, had instigated all of this by making indiscreet remarks about the excellence of modern spelecaptors. This was hardly Barb's fault, but it did create a negative association in one's mind that bobbed to the surface at awkward moments. And Barb was a copious source of awkward moments.
Well, that would explain the closure of the Starhenge, Arcibald said. Let us suppose, for the sake of argument, that the secular power has divided into two or more factions, perhaps arming for war. One may have launched a reconnaissance satellite into a polar orbit.
Or several of them, Jesri said.
Since I got the impression I was making calculations for more than just one object.
Could it have been one object that changed its orbit from time to time? Tullia asked.
Unlikely. It takes a lot of energy to change an orbit from one plane to another. Almost as much energy as launching the satellite in the first place, Leo said.
Everyone looked at him.
Spy satellite Vlor,
he said sheepishly.
From a Praxic Age book on space warfare, plane change maneuvers are expensive.
A satellite in a polar orbit doesn't need to change its plane, Barb snorted. He can see all parts of Arb by waiting long enough.
There's one big reason why I like Jesri's hypothesis, I said.
Everyone turned and looked at me. I hadn't been talking much. But in the weeks since Anathem, I had come to be seen as an authority on all things Orlo. Orlo's behavior in the days just before Appert suggests that he knew there was going to be trouble. Whatever it was that he had seen, he knew that it was a secular event, and that the hierarchs would make him stop looking at it as soon as they found out. That wouldn't have been true if it was just a rock. I was only agreeing with the consensus. Most of the others nodded. But Arcibald, of all people, seemed to take what I'd said as a challenge. He cleared his throat and came back at me as if we were in dialogue.
Fra Erasmus, what you have said makes sense as far as it goes, but it doesn't go very far. Since Anathem was rung down on Orlo, it's easy for us to fall in the habit of thinking of him as a malcontent, but would you have identified him as such before Appert?
Your point is well taken, Fra Arcibald. Let's not waste time taking a poll of everyone standing around this fire. Orlo was as happy to abide under the discipline as any avowed who ever lived.
But the launching of a new reconnaissance satellite is clearly a secular event, is it not?
Yes.
And moreover, since that kind of praxis has been around for millennia, long enough that Fra Leo here can read of it in ancient books, there is nothing new that Orlo could have learned by making observations of such a satellite, is there?
Presumably not, unless it embodied some newly developed praxis.
But such a new praxis would also be a secular event, would it not? Tullia put in.
Yes, Sura Tullia, and therefore no concern of the avowed.
So, said Arcibald. If we accept the premise that Fra Orlo was a true avowed who respected the discipline, we cannot at the same time believe that the thing he saw in the sky was a satellite recently launched from the surface of Arb. Because, said Leo, completing the thought, he'd have identified any such thing as being of no interest to us.
All of which made sense, but it left us with nowhere to go, or at least nowhere we were willing to go. Except for Barb.
Therefore, it must be an alien ship.
Jesri inhaled deeply and let out a big sigh.
Fra Taverner, he said, using Barb's avowed name. Remind me to show you some research back in the library showing just how unlikely that is.
Unlikely, but not impossible, Fra Taverner shot back.
Jessery sighed again. Fra Jessery, I said, and managed to catch his eye and throw him a wry look. Exactly the kind of signal to which Barb was oblivious. Fra Taverner seems very keen on the topic. The fire's dying fast. We only have a few more minutes here. Why don't you go on ahead of us and show him that research? We'll put out the fire and tidy up. Everyone was quiet for a while because every one of us, including I, was startled by what had just happened. I had bossed Jessery around. Unprecedented. But I didn't care. I was too busy caring about other things.
Right, Jessery said,
and stomped off into the dark with Barb in tow. The rest of us stood there silently until the sound of Barb's questions had been drowned out by the seething of the fire and the burble of the river over ice shoals.
You want to talk about the tablet,
Leo predicted. It's time to bring that thing down and look at it, I said. I'm surprised you haven't been in more of a hurry, Tullia said. I've been dying to see that thing. Remember what happened to Orlo, I said. He was incautious. Or maybe he just didn't care whether he got caught. Do you care? Tullia asked. It was a blunt question that made the others uneasy. But no one edged away. They all looked at me, keen to hear my answer. The grief that had hit me at the moment Statho had called Orlo's name was still with me all the time. But I had learned that it could transform in a flash to anger. Not jumping up and down anger, but cold, implacable fury that settled in my viscera and made me think some most unpleasant thoughts. It was distorting my face. I knew this because younger Fids who had used to give me a pleasant greeting when I encountered them in a gallery or on the meadow now averted their eyes.
Frankly, no,
I said. This was a lie, but it felt good. I don't care whether I get thrown back. But you guys are all involved in it too, so I'm going to be careful for your sakes. Remember, this tablet might have no useful information whatsoever. Even if it does, we might have to stare into the thing for months or even years before we see anything. So we are talking about a lengthy and secret campaign. Well, it seems to me that we owe it to Orlo to try, Tullia said.
I can bring it down whenever you like,
Leo said.
I know of a dark room beneath Shuf's Dalmet where we could view it,
Arcibald said. Very well, I said. I only need a little bit of help from you guys. I'll do the rest myself. If I get caught, I'll say you knew nothing and I'll take responsibility for whatever happens. They'll give me Chapter 6 or worse, and then I'll walk out of here and try to find Orlo. These words made Tullia and Leo quite emotional in different ways. She looked ready to weep, and he looked ready to fight. But Arcibald was merely impatient with me for being so slow.
There is a larger matter at stake than getting in trouble, he said. You are avowed, Fra Erasmus. You swore a vow to keep the discipline. It's the most solemn and important thing in your life. That is what you are putting into play. Whether or not you get caught and punished is a detail.
Arcibald's words had a strong effect on me because they were true. I had an answer that was ready-made, but it wasn't one that I could speak aloud. I no longer respected that oath. Or at least, I no longer trusted those who were charged with enforcing the discipline to which I had sworn. But I couldn't very well say as much to these friends of mine who did still respect it. My mind worked for a while, looking for a way to answer Arcibald's challenge, and the others were content to stand there and poke at the dying fire and wait for me to speak. I trust Orlo, I finally said. I trust that, in his mind, he was in no way violating the discipline, that he was punished by lesser minds who don't understand what is really going on. I think he is... that he will be... Say it, Tullia snapped. Sant, I said. I will do this for Sant Orlo.
Part 5. Voco.
Lineage. 1. Extramuros. A line of hereditary descent. 2. Intramuros. A chronological sequence of Avowt who acquired and held property exceeding the Bolt, Cord, and Sphere, each conferring the property upon a chosen heir at the moment of death. The wealth, see Dowment, accumulated by some lineages, or at least rumors of it, fostered the Bawd iconography. Lineages were eliminated as part of the Third Sack reforms. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
Whatever you might say of his rich descendants, Fra Shouf had had little wealth and no plan. That became obvious as soon as you descended the flagstone stairs into the cellar of the place that he had started and his heirs had finished. I write cellar, but it is more true to say that there was some number of cellars, I never made an exact count, cemented to one another in some graph that no one fully understood. It was a real accomplishment, in a way, to have left such a mess under a building so small. Archibald, of course, had an explanation. Shouf's avocation was stonemason. He had begun the project, circa 1200, as a sort of eccentric pastime. He had meant only to build a narrow tower with a room at the top where one of Out could sit and meditate. That done, he had passed it on to a Fid who had noticed the tower beginning to lean and had spent much of his life replacing the foundation, a tetchy sort of undertaking that involved digging out cavities beneath what was already there and socking huge stone blocks into the holes. He'd ended up with more foundation than was really needed and passed it on to another mason who had done more digging, more foundation work, and more wall building. And so it had gone for some generations until the lineage had begun to gather wealth beyond the building itself and had needed a place to store it. The old foundation work had then been rediscovered, re-excavated, walled, floored, vaulted, and extended. For one of the toxic things about lineages was that rich Avowt could get not-so-rich ones to do things for them in exchange for better food, better drink, and better lodging. Anyway, by the time that the reformed old Fanians had begun sneaking back to the ruin of Shouf's Dalment, hundreds of years after the Third Sack, the earth had reclaimed much of the cellars. I wasn't sure how the dirt got into those places and covered the floor so deep. Some process humans couldn't fathom because it went on so gradually. The ROF, who had been so diligent about fixing up the above-ground part, had almost completely ignored the cellars. To your right, as you reached the bottom of the stairs, there was one chamber where they stored wine and some silver table service that was hauled out for special occasions. Beyond that, the cellars were a wilderness. Archibald, contrary to his reputation, had become its intrepid explorer. His maps were ancient floor plans that he found in the library, and his tools were a pickaxe and a shovel. The mystical object of his quest was a vaulted sub-basement that, according to legend, was where Shouf's lineage had stored its gold. If any such place had ever existed, it had been found and cleaned out during the Third Sack, but to rediscover it would be interesting. It would also be a boon for the ROF, since in recent years, Avowt of other orders had entertained themselves by circulating rumors to the effect that the ROF had found or were accumulating treasure down there. Archibald could put such rumors to rest by finding the sub-basement and then inviting people to go and see for themselves. But there was no hurry. There never was with him, and no one was expecting results before Archibald's hair had turned white. From time to time he would come tromping back over the bridge covered with dirt and fill our bath with silt, and we would know he had gone on another expedition. So I was surprised when he took me down those stairs, turned left instead of right, led me through a few twists and turns that looked too narrow for him, and showed me a rusty plate in the floor of a dirty, wet-smelling room. He hauled it up to expose a cavity below and an aluminum stepladder that he had pilfered from somewhere else in the consent.
"I was obliged to saw the legs off, a little," he confessed, "as the ceiling is quite low. After you."
The legendary treasure vault turned out to be approximately one arm span wide and high. The floor was dirt. Archibald had spread out a polytarp so that perishable things,
such as your bony arse, Raz,
could exist here without continually drawing up moisture from the earth. Oh, and there wasn't any treasure. just a lot of graffiti carved into the walls by disappointed slines. It was just about the nastiest place imaginable to work, but we had almost no choices. It wasn't as if I could sit up on my pallet at night and throw my bolt over my head like a tent and stare at the forbidden tablet. We employed the oldest trick in the book, literally. In the old library, Tullia found a great big fat book that no one had pulled down from the shelf in 1,100 years, a compendium of papers about a kind of elementary particle theorics that had been all the rage from 2300 to 2600 when Saint Fenebrast had proved it was wrong. We cut a circle from each page until we had formed a cavity in the heart of this tome that was large enough to swallow the photomnemonic tablet. Leo carried it up to the Fendant Court in a stack of other books and brought it back down at supper time, much heavier, and handed it over to me. The next day I gave it to Archibald at breakfast. When I saw him at supper, he told me that the tablet was now in place.
"I looked at it, a little," he said.
"What did you learn?" I asked him.
"That the Eta have been diligent about keeping Clesthera's eye spotless," he said. "One of them comes every day to dust it. Sometimes he eats his lunch up there."
"A nice place for it," I said. "But I was thinking of nighttime observations."
"I'll leave those to you, Frau Erasmus."
Now I only wanted an excuse to go to Schufsdalmet a lot. Here at last, politics worked in my favor. Those who looked askance at the ROF's fixing up the Dalmet did so because it seemed like a sneaky way of getting something for nothing. If asked, the ROF would always insist that anyone was welcome to go there and work. But new circles, and especially Adharians, rarely did so. Partly this was the usual inter-order rivalry. Partly it was current events.
"How have your brothers and sisters been treating you lately?" Tullia asked me one day as we were walking back from Provener. The shape of her voice was not warm fuzzy, more curious analytical.
I turned around to walk backwards in front of her so that I could look at her face. She got annoyed and raised her eyebrows. She was coming of age in a month. After that, she could take part in liaisons without violating the discipline. Things between us had become awkward.
"Why do you ask?" "Just curious," I said.
"Stop making a spectacle of yourself and I'll tell you." I hadn't realized I was making a spectacle of myself, but I turned back around and fell in step beside her.
"There is a new strain of thought," Tullia said, "that Orlo was actually thrown back as retribution for the politicking that took place during the Eliger season."
"Phew," was the most eloquent thing I could say about that. I walked on in silence for a while. It was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard. If you couldn't be thrown back for stealing mead and selling it on the black market to buy forbidden consumer goods, then what wouldn't bring down the anathem? And yet, ideas like that are evil, I said, because some creepy, crawly part of your brain wants to believe in them, even while your logical mind is blasting them to pieces.
Well, some among the Adharians have been letting their creepy, crawly brains get the better of them, Tullia said. They don't want to believe in the mead and the Spelecaptor. Apparently, Orlo brokered a three-way deal that sent Archibald to the ROF in exchange for...
Stop, I said. I don't want to hear it.
You know what Orlo did, and so it's easier for you to accept, she said. Others are having trouble with it. They want to make it into a political conspiracy and say that the thing with the mead never happened.
Not even I am that cynical about Sura Trestinus, I said. In the corner of my eye, I saw Tullia turn her head to look at me.
Okay, I admitted. Let me put it differently. I don't think she's a conspiracist. I think she's just plain evil.
That seemed to satisfy Tullia.
Look, I said, Fra Orlo used to say that the Consent was just like the outside world, except with fewer shiny objects. I had no idea what he was getting at. Now that he's gone, I see it. Our knowledge doesn't make us better or wiser. We can be just as nasty as those slines that beat up Leo and Archibald for the fun of it.
Did Orlo have an answer?
I think he did, I said. He was trying to explain it to me during Appert.
Look for things that have beauty. It tells you that a ray is shining in from,
a true place? The Hylaean theoric world?
Again, her face was hard to read. She wanted to know whether I believed in all that stuff, and I wanted to know if she did.
I reckon the stakes were higher for her. As an Adharian, I could get away with it.
Yeah, I said.
I don't know if he would have called it by that name, but it's what he was driving at.
Well, she said, after giving it a few moments' thought, it's better than spending your life swapping conspiracy theories.
That's not saying much, I thought, but I didn't say it out loud. The decision Tullia had made to join the new circle was a real decision with real consequences, one of which was that she must be guarded when talking about ideas like the HTW that they considered to be superstitions. She could believe in that stuff if she wanted, but she had to keep it to herself, and it was bad form for me to try to pry it out of her. Anyway, I now had an excuse to hang around at Shuf's Dalmont. I was trying to act as a peacemaker among the orders by accepting the ROF's standing invitation. After breakfast each morning, I would attend a lecture, typically with Barb, and work with him on proofs and problems until provener and the midday meal. After that, I would go out to the back part of the meadow where Leo and I were getting ready for the weed war and work, or pretend to, for a while. I kept an eye on the bay window of the Shuf's Dalmont, up on the hill on the other side of the river. Archibald kept a stack of books on the windowsill next to his big chair. If someone else was there, he would turn these so that their spines were toward the window. I could see their dark brown bindings from the meadow. But if he found himself alone, he would turn them so that their white page edges were visible. When I noticed this, I would stop work, go to a niche gallery, fetch my Theorix notes, and carry them over the bridge and through the page tree coppice to Shuf's Dalmont, as if I were going there to study. A few minutes later, I'd be down in the subcellar, sitting cross-legged on that tarp and working with the tablet. When I was finished, I would come back up through the cellars. Before ascending the flagstone steps, I would look for another signal. If someone else was in the building, Archibald would close the door at the top of the stairs. But if he were alone, he'd leave it ajar. One of the many advantages that photomnemonic tablets held over ordinary phototypes was that they made their own light, so you could work with them in the dark. This tablet began and ended with daylight. If I ran it back to the very beginning, it became a featureless pool of white light with a faint bluish tinge, the unfocused light of sun and sky that had washed over the tablet after I had activated it on top of the pinnacle during Fra Paflagon's voco. If I put the tablet into play mode, I could then watch a brief, funny-looking transition as it had been slid into Clesthera's eye, and then, suddenly, an image, perfectly crisp and clear, but geometrically distorted. Most of the disc was a picture of the sky. The sun was a neat white circle off-center. Around the tablet's rim was a dark, uneven fringe, like a moldy rind on a wheel of cheese. The horizon, all of it, in every direction. In this fisheye geometry, down for us humans, i.e. toward the ground, was always outward toward the rim of the tablet. Up was always inward toward the center. If several people had stood in a circle around Clesthera's eye, their waists would have appeared around the circumference of the image and their heads would have projected inwards, like spokes of a wheel. So much information was crammed into the tablet's outer fringe that I had to use its pan and zoom functions to make sense of it. The bright sky disk seemed to have a deep, dark notch cut into it at one place. On closer examination, this was the pedestal of the zenith mirror, which stood right next to Clesthera's eye. Like the north arrow on a map, this gave me a reference point that I could use to get my bearings and find other things. About halfway around the rim from it, was a wider, shallower notch in the sky disk, difficult to make sense of. But if I turned it about the right way and gave my eye a moment to get used to the distortion, I could understand it as a human figure, wrapped in a bolt that covered everything except one hand and forearm. These were reaching radially outward, which meant down, and became grotesquely oversized before being cropped by the edge of the tablet. This monstrosity was me, reaching toward the base of the eye, having just inserted the tablet and secured the dust cover. The first time I saw this, I laughed out loud because it made my elbow look as big as the moon, and by zooming in on it, I could see a mole and count the hairs and freckles. My attempt to hide my identity by hooding myself had been a joke. If Sura Trustanez had found this tablet, she could have found the culprit by going around and examining everyone's right elbow. When I let the tablet play forward, I could see the notch that was me melt into the dark horizon rim as I departed. A few moments later, a dark mote streaked around the tablet in a long arc close to the rim, the aircraft that had taken Fra Paflagon away to the Pangendrums. By freezing this and zooming in, I could see the aircraft clearly, not quite so badly distorted because it was farther away. The rotors and the streams of exhaust from its engines, frozen, the pilot's face, mostly covered by a dark visor, caught in sunlight shining through the windscreen, his lips parted as if he were speaking into the microphone that curved alongside his cheek. When I ran the time point forward a few minutes, I was able to see the aircraft flying back in the other direction, this time with the face of Fra Paflagon framed in a side window, gazing back at the consent as if he had never seen it before. Then, by sliding my finger up along the side of the tablet for a short distance, I was able to make the sun commit its arc across the sky disk and sink into the horizon. The tablet went dark. Stars must be recorded on it, but my eyes couldn't see them very well because they hadn't adjusted to the dark yet. A few red comets flashed across it, the lights of aircraft. Then the disk brightened again, and the sun exploded from the edge and launched itself across the sky the next morning. If I ran my finger all the way up the side of the tablet in one continuous motion, it flashed like a strobe light. 78 flashes in all, one for each day that the tablet had lodged in Clesthera's eye. Coming to the last few seconds and slowing down the playback, I was able to watch myself emerging from the top of the stairs and approaching the eye to remove the tablet during Fra Orlo's anathem. But I hated to see this part of it because of the way my face looked. I only checked it once, just to be sure that the tablet had continued recording all the way until the moment I had retrieved it. I erased the first and last few seconds of the recording, so that if the tablet were confiscated, it would not contain any images of me. Then I began reviewing it in greater detail. Archibald had mentioned seeing the Eta in this thing. Sure enough, on the second day, a little after noon, a dark bulge reached in from the rim and blotted out most of the sky for a minute. I ran it back and played it at normal speed. It was one of the Eta. He approached from the top of the stairs carrying a squirt bottle and a rag. He spent a minute cleaning the zenith mirror, then approached Clesthera's eye, which was when his image really became huge, and sprayed cleaning fluid on it. I flinched as if the stuff were being sprayed into my face. He gave it a good polish. I could see all the way up into his nostrils and count the hairs. I could see the tiny veins in his eyeballs and the striations in his iris. So there was no doubt that this was Saman, the Eta whom Jessery and I had stumbled upon in Cord's machine hall. In a moment he became much smaller as he backed away from the eye. But he did not depart from the top of the pinnacle immediately. He stood there for several moments, bobbed out of view, reappeared, approached, and loomed in Clesthera's eye for a little bit, then finally went away. I zoomed in and watched that last bit again. After he polished the lens, he looked down as if he had dropped something. He stooped over, which made all but his backside disappear beyond the rim of the tablet. When he stood up, bulging back into the picture again, he had something new in his hand, a rectangular object about the size of a book. I didn't have to zoom in on this to know what it was. The dust jacket that, a day previously, I had torn off of this very tablet. The wind had snatched it from my hand, and in my haste to leave, I had, like an idiot, left it lying where it had fallen. Saman examined it for a minute, turning it this way and that. After a while, he seemed to get an idea of what it was. His head snapped around to look at me, at Clesthera's eye, rather. He approached and peered into the lens, then cocked his head, reached down, and I guessed, though I couldn't see, prodded the little door that covered the tablet slot. His face registered something. If I had wanted, I could have zoomed in on his eyeballs and seen what was reflected in them. But I didn't need to, because the look on his face told all. Less than 24 hours after I had slipped that tablet into Clesthera's eye, someone else in this consent had known about it. Saman stood there for another minute, pondering. Then he folded up the dust jacket, inserted it into a breast pocket of his cloak, turned his back on me, and walked away. I moved the tablet forward to a cloudy night, thereby plunging myself into almost total blackness, and I sat there in that hole in the ground and tried to get over this. I was remembering the other evening, standing around the campfire, when I had criticized Orlo for being incautious and told my friends that I'd be much more careful. What an idiot I was. Watching Saman pick up that dust jacket and put two and two together, my face had flushed and my heart had thumped as if I were actually there on top of the pinnacle with him. But this was just a recording of something that had happened months ago, and nothing had come of it. Granted, Saman could spill the beans any time he chose. That was unnerving, but I could do nothing about it. Feeling embarrassed by a mistake I'd made months ago was a waste of time. Better to think about what I was going to do now. Sit here in the dark, worrying? Or keep investigating the contents of this tablet? Put that way, it wasn't a very difficult question. The fury that had taken up residence in my gut was a kind of anger that had to be acted upon. The action didn't need to be sudden or dramatic. If I had joined one of the other orders, I might have made acting upon it into a sort of career. Using it as fuel, I could have spent the next 10 or 20 years working my way up the hierarch ranks, looking for ways to make life nasty for those who had wronged Orlo. But the fact of the matter was that I had joined the Adharians, and thereby made myself powerless as far as the internal politics of the consent were concerned. So I tended to think in terms of murdering Fra Spelican. Such was my anger that for a little while this actually made sense, and from time to time, I'd find myself musing about how to carry it off. There were a lot of big knives in the kitchen. So how fortunate it was that I had this tablet, and a place in which to view it. It gave me something to act on. Something, that is, besides Fra Spelican's throat. If I worked on it hard enough, and were lucky, perhaps I could come up with some result that I could announce one evening in the refectory to the humiliation of Spelican, Trustinus, and Statho. Then I could storm out of the consent in disgust before they had time to throw me back. And in the meantime, studying this thing answered that need in my gut to take some kind of action in response to what had been inflicted on Orlo, and I had found that taking such action was the only way to transmute my anger back into grief. And when I was grieving instead of angry, young Fids no longer shied away from me, and my mind was no longer filled with images of blood pumping from Frost Bellicon's severed arteries. So I had no choice but to put Saman and the dust cover out of my mind and concentrate instead on what Clesthera's eye had seen during the nighttime. I had kept track of the weather those 77 nights. More than half had been cloudy. There had only been 17 nights of really clear seeing. Once I allowed my eyes to adjust to the darkness, it was easy to find north on this thing, because it was the pole around which all the stars revolved. If the image was frozen, or playing back at something like normal speed, the stars appeared as stationary points of light. But if I sped up the playback, each star, with the exception of the pole star, traced an arc centered on the pole as Arb rotated beneath it. Our fancier telescopes had polar axis systems driven by the clock that eliminated this problem. These telescopes rotated backwards at the same speed as Arb rotated forwards, so that the stars remained stationary above them. Clesthera's eye was not so equipped. The tablet could be commanded to tell what it had seen in several different ways. To this point, I'd been using it like a spielecaptor with its play, pause, and fast-forward buttons. But it could do things that spielecaptors couldn't, such as integrate an image over a span of time. This was an echo of the Praxic Age when, instead of tablets like this one, cosmographers had used plates coated with chemicals sensitive to light. Because many of the things they looked at were so faint, they had often needed to expose those plates for hours at a time. A photomnemonic tablet worked both ways. If you were to play back such a record in spielecaptor mode, you might see nothing more than a few stars and a bit of haze. But if you configured the tablet to show the still image integrated over time, a spiral galaxy or nebula might pop out. So my first experiment was to select a night that had been clear and configure the tablet to integrate all the light that Klesthera's eye had taken in that night into a single still image. The first results weren't very good because I set the start time too early and the stop time too late, so everything was washed out by the brightness in the sky after dusk and before dawn. But after making some adjustments, I was able to get the image I wanted. It was a black disk etched with thousands of fine concentric arcs, each of which was the track made by a particular star or planet as Arb spun beneath it. This image was crisscrossed by several red dotted lines and brilliant white streaks, the traces made by the lights of aircraft passing across our sky. The ones in the center, made by high-flying craft, ran nearly straight. Over toward one edge, the starfield was all but obliterated by a sheaf of fat white curves, craft coming in to land at the local aerodrome, all following more or less the same glide path. Only one thing in this whole firmament did not move. The pole star. If our hypothesis was correct as to what Fra Orlo had been looking for, namely something in a polar orbit, then, assuming it was bright enough to be seen on this thing, it ought to register as a streak passing near the pole star. It would be straight, or nearly so, and oriented at right angles to the myriad arcs made by the stars. It would move north-south as they moved east-west. Not only that, but such a satellite should make more than one such streak on a given night. Jezri and I had worked it out. A satellite in a low orbit should make a complete pass around Arb in about an hour and a half. If it made a streak on the tablet as it passed over the pole at, say, midnight, then at about 1:30 it should make another streak, and another at 3, and another at 4:30. It should always stay in the same plane with respect to the fixed stars. But during each of those 90-minute intervals, Arb would rotate through 22.5 degrees of longitude. And so the successive streaks that a given satellite made should not be drawn on top of each other. Instead, they should be separated by angles of about 22.5 degrees, or pi over 8 as the Oritians measured angles. They should look like cuts on a pie. My work on that first day in the subcellar consisted of making the tablet produce a time exposure for the first clear night, then zooming in on the vicinity of the pole star and looking for something that resembled a pie-cutting diagram. I succeeded in this so easily that I was almost disappointed. Because there was more than one such satellite, what it looked like was more complex. But if I looked at it long enough, I could see it as several different pie-cut diagrams piled on top of each other. "It's an anticlimax," I told Jessery at supper. We had somehow managed to avoid Barb and sit together in a corner of the refectory.
"Again?"
"I'd sort of thought that if I could see anything at all in a polar orbit, that'd be the end of it. Mystery solved, case closed, but it is not so. There are several satellites in polar orbits, probably have been ever since the Praxic Age. Old ones wear out and fall down. The Pangendrums launch new ones."
"That is not a new result," he pointed out. "If you go out at night and stand facing north and wait long enough, you can see those things hurtling over the pole with the naked eye."
I chewed a bit of food as I struggled to master the urge to punch him in the nose. But this was how things were done in Theorix. It wasn't only the Lorites who said, "That is not a new result." People reinvented the wheel all the time. There was nothing shameful in it. If the rest of us oohed and awed and said, "Gosh, a wheel, no one's ever thought of that before," just to make that person feel good, nothing would ever get done. But still it stung to risk so much and do so much work to get a result only to be told it was nothing new. "I don't claim it is a new result," I told him, with elaborate patience. "I'm only letting you know what happened the first time I was able to spend a couple of hours with the tablet. And I guess I am posing a question."
"All right. What is the question?"
Fra Orlo must have known that there were several satellites in polar orbits and that this wasn't a big deal. To a cosmographer, it's no more remarkable than aircraft flying overhead.
"An annoyance, a distraction," Jessery said, nodding.
So what was it that he risked Anatham to see?
He didn't just risk Anatham.
I waved him off. You know what I mean. This is no time to go Kephidocles.
Jessery gazed into space above my left shoulder.
Most others would have been embarrassed or irritated by my remark.
Not him.
He couldn't care less. Oh, how I envied him.
We knew that he needed a spelecaptor to see it, Jessery said. The naked eye wasn't good enough.
He had to see all of this in a different way. He couldn't make time exposures on a tablet, I put in.
The best he could do once the Starhenge had been locked was to stand out in that vineyard, freezing his arse off, looking at the pole star through the spelecaptor, waiting for something to streak across.
When it showed up, it would zoom across the viewfinder in a few moments, I said.
We were completing each other's sentences now.
But then what? What would he have learned?
The time, Jessery said. He would know what time it was.
He shifted his gaze to the tabletop, as if it were a spiele of Orlo.
He makes a note of it. 90 minutes later, he looks again. He sees the same bird making its next pass over the pole.
Leo referred to satellites as birds. This was military slang he had picked up from books, and the rest of us had adopted the term.
That sounds about as interesting as watching the hour hand on a clock, I said.
Well, but remember, there's more than one of these birds, he said.
I don't have to remember it. I spent the whole afternoon looking at them, I reminded him.
But Jessery was on the trail of an idea and had no time for me and my petty annoyance.
They can't all be orbiting at the same altitude, he said. Some must be higher than others. Those would have longer periods. Instead of 90 minutes, they might take 91 or 103 minutes to go around. By timing their orbits, Fra Orlo could, by making enough observations, compile sort of
a census, I said.
A list of all the birds that were up there. Once he had that in hand, if there was any change, any anomaly, he'd be able to detect it. But until such time as he had completed that census, as you call it,
he'd be working in the dark in more ways than one, wouldn't he? I said.
He'd see a bird pass over the pole, but he wouldn't know which bird it was or if there was anything unusual about it.
So that's true. We have to follow in his footsteps, Jessery said.
Your first objective should be to compile such a census.
That is much easier for me than it was for Orlo, I said. Just looking at the tracks on the tablet, you can see that some are more widely spread, bigger slices of the pie, than others. Those must be the high flyers.
Once you get used to looking at these images, you might be able to notice anomalies just by their general appearance, Jessery speculated.
Which was easy for him to say, since he wasn't the one doing it.
For the last little while, he had seemed restless and bored. Now he broke eye contact, gazed around the refectory as if seeking someone more interesting, but then turned his attention back to me.
New topic, he announced.
Affirmative. State name of topic, I answered.
But if he knew I was making fun of him, he didn't show it.
Fra Paflagon.
The hundreder who is evoked.
Yes.
Orlo's mentor.
Yes. The Steelyard says that his voco and the trouble Orlo got into must be connected.
Seems reasonable, I said.
I guess I've sort of been assuming that.
Normally, we'd have no way of knowing what a hundreder was working on. Not until the next centennial apert, anyway. But before Paflagon went into the upper labyrinth, 22 years ago, he wrote some treatises that got sent out into the world at the decennial apert of 3670. 10 years later, and again just a few months ago, our library got its usual decennial deliveries. So I've been going through all that stuff, looking for anything that references Paflagon's work.
Seems really indirect, I pointed out.
We've got all of Paflagon's work right here, don't we?
Yeah, but that's not what I'm looking for, Jessery said.
I'm more interested in knowing who, out there, was paying attention to Paflagon. Who read his works of 3670 and thought he had an interesting mind
because someone, I said, getting it, someone out there in the secular world must have said, Paflagon's our man, yank him and bring him to us.
Exactly.
So what have you found?
Well, that's the thing, Jessery said. Turns out Paflagon had two careers, in a way.
What do you mean, like an avocation?
You could say his avocation was philosophy. Metatheorics. Prokeans might even call it a sort of religion. On the one hand, he's a proper cosmographer, doing the same sort of stuff as Orlo. But in his spare time, he's thinking big ideas and writing it down, and people on the outside noticed.
What kind of ideas?
I don't want to go there now, Jessery said.
Well, damn it!
He held up a hand to settle me. Read it yourself. That's not what I'm about. I'm about trying to reckon who picked him and why. There's lots of cosmographers, right?
Sure.
So if he was evoked to answer cosmography questions, you have to ask, why him in particular?
Yeah.
But it's rare to work on the metatheorical stuff he was interested in.
I see where you're going, I said. The Steelyard tells us he must have been evoked for that, not the cosmography.
Yeah, Jessery said. Anyway, not that many people paid attention to Paphlagon's metatheorics, at least judging from the stuff we got in the deliveries of 3680 and 3690. But there's one sewer at Barato, name of Akulawa, who really seems to admire him, has written two books about Paphlagon's work.
Tenor or...
No, that's just it. She's a Unarian, 34 years straight.
So she was a teacher.
There was no other reason to spend more than a few years in a Unarian math. Latter Evanadrician, Jessery said, answering my next question before I'd asked it.
I don't know much about that order.
Well, remember when Orlo told us that Sant Evanedric worked on different stuff during the second half of his career?
Actually, I think Arcibald's the one who told us that, but...
Jessery shrugged off my correction. The latter Evanadricians are interested in exactly that stuff.
All right, I said.
So you reckon Sur Akulawa fingered Paphlagon?
No way.
She's a philosophy teacher, a one-off...
Yeah, but at one of the big three...
That's my point, Jessery said, a little testy. A lot of important seculars did a few years at Big Three Maths when they were younger before they went out and started their careers.
You think this sewer had a fid 10 or 15 years ago, maybe, who's gone on to become a pangendrum?
Akulawa taught the fid all about how great and wise Frau Paphlagon was, and now something's happened.
Something, Jessery said, nodding confidently,
that made that ex-fid say, that tears it. We need Paphlagon here yesterday.
But what could that something be?
Jessery shrugged. That's the whole question, isn't it?
Maybe we could get a clue by investigating Paphlagon's writings.
That is obvious, Jessery said. But it's rather difficult when Arcibald's using them as a semaphore. It took me a moment to make sense of this.
That stack of books in the window.
Jessery nodded. Arcibald took everything Paphlagon ever wrote to Schuf's Dalmont.
I laughed.
Well then, what about Sur Akulawa?
Tullia's going through her works now, Jessery said, trying to figure out if she had any fids who amounted to anything.